This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
I,
Kim Janey,
do solemnly swear that I will support the Constitution of the United States.
That I will support the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Madam Mayor.
That is Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Kimberly Butt, the first Black woman to lead the SJC, swearing in Kim Janey, now the first Black and first woman mayor of Boston. WBUR's Anthony Brooks was there today. He joins us now. Anthony, welcome.
Hey, hi, Tiziana. Nice to be here.
So watching it from afar this morning, you know, online, Anthony, I was remembering being present when Ayanna Pressley was first sworn in as a city councilwoman. And it was, you know, historic. And you could feel it in the room. What did it feel like to be there today?
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good way to describe it. I mean, there was a lot of history being made there. Obviously, we've talked a lot about Mayor Janey being the first Black person, the first woman to lead the city in its 200-year history. So that alone made this day historic. But consider as well, and you mentioned this, that the new mayor was sworn in by Chief Justice Kimberly Budd, the first Black woman to lead the state's highest court. And she was introduced by Congresswoman Pressley, who was the first woman of color to serve on the Boston City Council and the first woman of color to be elected to Congress in Massachusetts. So a lot of firsts, a lot of historic changes for this city and state. And Mayor Janey spoke to some of us after she was sworn in and quoted Ayanna Pressley saying, "This isn't just breaking through a glass ceiling, it's crashing through a concrete ceiling." And she said also, by the way, that this is as much as this is a great day for Boston, she pointed out that a lot of other cities got to this point a lot sooner. So it took a while. And here's a clip from a little more about what she had to say during her prepared remarks.
"I come to this day with life experience that is different from the men who came before me. I was born into a family with deep roots in the South End and six generations in Roxbury, the center of our great city. I come from a long line of proud educators, entrepreneurs, artists, and advocates."
Janey said today's a new day. She also tipped her hat to her predecessor, Marty Walsh, calling him a son of Dorchester whose achievements make us all proud.
So, Anthony, she just referred to the men who came before her. They were all white men. So what do you expect to see in how Mayor Janey leads since she has shifted that focus to her unique perspective? What do you think her priorities will be?
Well, she made clear that her priorities include tackling a series of challenges that are all linked to a lack of fairness, a lack of equity, and inclusivity in the city. For example, she talked about the need to address the wealth gap in Boston, as well as a health gap that afflicts communities of color. She talked about the need to, in her words, dismantle systemic racism, including reforming how we police the city. And in terms of immediate priorities, she said she would continue to address the pandemic, ensuring that the vaccine is rolled out fairly and reaches all communities. So here's a bit more of what she had to say about that.
"Let's be clear. The problems laid bare by the pandemic were here well before COVID-19. The issues of affordable housing, fair wages, public transportation, and climate change are not new. What's different is that these problems now impact even more of us."
So, Anthony, normally an event like this would be packed, you know, watching virtually today. It couldn't be. It clearly wasn't. But who was there? And did you talk to anybody after the ceremony?
Yeah. I mean, members of her family were there, of course. There were a handful of public officials. But, of course, because of COVID protocols, it was a fairly small group that gathered on the third floor mezzanine at City Hall. I spoke to Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins, among others, who says he's excited that Boston has a Black woman as a mayor. He says more than anything, he appreciates the change that she represents and her message of inclusivity.
"She just mentioned to me that she wants to have a conversation with me about corrections and public safety and policing. She was just installed to then turn to me to say, I want to have this conversation. Says yes, that speaks loudly to inclusiveness. And I think that's going to be a very serious and vibrant thing. And I look forward to those conversations."
And Tompkins believes that even as an acting mayor, Janey is going to be able to make a big difference in the months ahead.
And so what will you watch for, Anthony, now that as acting mayor, day one has started?
Well, I mean, I think all of us are curious to know if Janie's going to jump into the race for mayor. She hasn't said that yet, and she was asked again today by reporters if she was going to get into the race. There are already, as you know, five candidates who are in the race. You know, I understand why she's not going to declare her intentions just yet. I mean, first she needs to focus on being mayor, and she has to get that right. And in terms of the politics, if she does intend to run, it's to her advantage to use the power of incumbency rather than just jumping into a crowded field. So she said that she would be letting us know in the coming weeks whether she was going to be running. So that will be an interesting moment to hear about.
We will watch for it with you. That's WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Anthony, thanks for giving us your time today.
Hey, my pleasure.
So from City Hall to the State House, legislators on the COVID-19 Oversight Committee held their second hearing yesterday, which once again featured some tense moments between Governor Baker and the members of the legislature. WBUR's Steve Brown is covering that story and joins us now. Steve, welcome back.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So this is the second time, Steve. Last time, lawmakers had some strong criticisms of Governor Baker's handling of the rollout. Did you hear the same kind of themes yesterday?
Yeah, I did. Keep in mind, when folks who are eligible aren't able to secure an appointment to get vaccinated, many pick up the phone or fire off an email to their state legislator. So lawmakers are getting an earful from their constituents about this process. So many legislators are also concerned about the equity in vaccine distribution. They point to stats that show that while 24% of the white population has been fully vaccinated, only 4% of Latinx population are fully vaccinated. They want to know why. Now, Governor Baker acknowledged that more does need to be done, but quickly pointed to the overall numbers, which show that on a per capita basis, Massachusetts leads most other states. But lawmakers still pushed back on that. Now, here's Arlington State Senator Cindy Friedman. She's the vice chair of the committee, who at one point said that lawmakers and the governor are living in two different worlds.
And I guess your understanding of what's going on and my understanding of what's going on are really different, because I just keep hearing, how are we going to get to those people who, you know, work, who are the dishwashers, who are the Mrs. Jones, who is afraid to leave her house, who are people who don't have transportation, are people who work during the day and aren't open during the sites. These are the people that we keep hearing from.
Now, Senator Friedman was clearly frustrated by what she's been hearing from the administration, as were many of her colleagues on the committee.
Something that came up since the last hearing was this fact that for years the state had been planning, spent millions planning and setting up infrastructure for a public health emergency vaccines. But then when this rollout began, the governor abandoned that and mostly turned to private companies. Did that come up, and how did that play out?
Yeah, it was. The local boards of health are basically saying, hey, what about us? We're here and we're ready and we have these plans in place. Now, here's Dawn Carmen Sebor. She's the executive director of the Mass Health Officers Association, testifying at yesterday's hearing about exactly that.
The plans have been tested and should have been and still should be used as a basis by which to distribute vaccine in the Commonwealth. The command center, however, has not chosen to use these plans. The administration instead has spent hundreds of millions more taxpayer dollars to hire consultants and private organizations to run its clinics while ignoring the plans and capabilities available from local health departments.
Now, Sebor told the legislators the inconsistent, ever-changing messages from the command center around the availability of vaccine at local health departments caused unnecessary confusion, fear, and increased vaccine hesitancy among residents.
So when the governor took the chair, how did he respond to that criticism, Steve?
Yeah, he said the local boards of health are not being completely frozen out and that many are participating in regional collaboratives. He defended his decisions and again compared the rollout in Massachusetts to other large population states.
But I think the change we made is also borne out by the fact that we're the number one state in the country across almost every measure that the CDC keeps track of for states that have more than 4 million people. We have a long way to go and a ton of work to do, and I wouldn't begin to say for a minute we don't. But I do believe, given all the issues associated with supply, the nature of the rollout, how fast it has to happen, and how people needed to manage the product itself, we made the right decision.
Now, the governor did hint that once the supply of that single-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine ramps up, the locals will be playing a larger role. But on that supply front, the governor had some discouraging news. The feds told governors earlier this week that instead of the states getting 4 to 6 million J&J doses this week, as they thought they would, they'll only be getting 2 million. And that's not just for Massachusetts. That's for all the states.
Okay, I want to stop there then, because that caught my attention, because last week when the governor announced all the different phases of when people could get vaccinated, one of the things he said was that he'd heard from the federal government more optimistic projections on J&J. Were you surprised to hear that yesterday?
Yeah, it's kind of a bonus. At first they were told, no, you're not going to get any Johnson & Johnson in the month of March. So they wrote it off. Okay, we're not getting any in March. And then last week, oh, no, okay, you're going to get some. Here's a little bit. And then they, oh, you're going to get a little bit more. No, you're only getting 2 million instead of 6 million. So again, those numbers are jumping up and down. Originally, they weren't expecting anything until April 1st. Then they were told, okay, you know, you're gonna get some in March, so you plan for that. And now it's well, not as much. So they're getting a lot of the back and forth from the feds as well.
Steve, in a sentence, what are you going to watch for coming out of these hearings?
I think if that vaccine supply actually does increase, he has pointed to the limited supply as the main reason why the rollout hasn't been ideal. If they can get those Johnson & Johnson shots out there, more of these public health departments and doctor's offices and fire stations and all of these places will probably be participating a lot more and getting more and more people in Massachusetts vaccinated.
All right. Well, that would be good. WBUR's Steve Brown. Steve, thanks for reporting to us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
53% of women in Massachusetts have reported reducing or considering reducing their hours at work. 39% have said that changes in childcare and educational arrangements have affected their work performance. Nearly 3 million women in the U.S. have left the workforce in this last year, and 21% in Massachusetts as of today are still considering quitting their jobs. That data from a survey by the Massachusetts Commission on the Status of Women. Here's Danella Clark of the commission.
When you're forced to say, I've got to stay home to help my kid with remote learning, that's the choice most women are going to make, because you can't do it all. And if you try to do it all, you will have a mental breakdown.
This pandemic has been projected to set women back a decade in the workplace. And we want to put some voices to those numbers. And that includes your voice. Are you a working woman who's been tried by this pandemic, a working mom specifically, or maybe somebody who has had to rethink a support role to or for a working woman or mom in your life? Tell us your stories. We'll give you more opportunities throughout this whole segment, but call now, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have two women with us today for whom this hits home. Kiana Agbai, a Boston parent, entrepreneur, and author of the blog and Instagram account Harlem Lovebirds, and Jenny Weiner, a Somerville parent and associate professor of educational leadership at the University of Connecticut. We've talked to you both during this pandemic. Great to have you back, Kiana, Jenny. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Kiana, you just heard those statistics. We've seen a ton of headlines. This pandemic is weighing heavily on working women, especially moms. What has it been like for you, living it every day?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of back and forth as far as managing just the family and work life. And I think where we're at currently with schools starting to bring children back in or planning to, it's another moment where I feel as a parent, I'm kind of holding my breath and figuring out, okay, how do I need to navigate? How do things need to switch around? So it still feels like there's a lot of flux, you know, 1 year later.
Are you holding your breath, listeners? I really, that sentence from Kiana really stuck out to me. Are you having to pivot? Are you constantly adjusting? Is there a moment you're waiting for where you think it might get easier or better? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jenny, I'm going to turn to you. I remember we spoke with you really right at the beginning, and you had written in the New York Times about how you refused to run a coronavirus homeschool, basically. Essentially, you weren't going to try to fill the void made present by the absence of school. Okay, but it's been a year now, and I don't think we thought it was going to be back then. So how has that evolved for you over time?
Yes, yes. I mean, if anything changes, it's time. So how has it evolved? It's been tremendously difficult. I mean, I've been working full time as my husband has. We've been trying to manage everything that our school district has been providing for our students. We have twin 9-year-old boys, and we're so grateful for that. But to attempt to, you know, work full time and have one boy on the left and one on the right, it's been a lot. I've tried to hold on to ideas about grace, giving myself grace and giving them grace, giving the unprecedented events. But we're really worn out. We're all feeling it acutely. And I think, you know, holding our breath is definitely something we're doing in our household as well. I didn't want this time to change the parameters of my relationships with my kid and change me from a mother and someone trying to give care and comfort during this time into an officer, sort of overseeing and keeping them on track. And unfortunately, I think those things have sometimes blended in ways that haven't been the best for our family. But we're chugging along and we're, you know, trying to maintain hope and good humor as we go.
Man, Jenny, that idea of not wanting to have to be the school enforcer really resonates with me. Kiana, have you had similar feelings and experiences?
Oh, absolutely. And I think the point of managing those relationships within the family, it's been a real challenge for me. And I know in the past when we've spoken before, I've talked about the importance of maintaining therapy throughout all of this. And so being able to make that priority has been important. And I know there's been just in general, in our culture lately, this talk on the importance of mental health and accessibility to mental health. And that's something that I've been paying a lot more attention to. And even for my own children, staying on top of their mental well-being. And I think prioritizing that, yes, we are doing our schoolwork and doing the best we can. But I think long-term, as a parent, I'm thinking about what are the long-term implications of this year and what does this possibly look like on the flip side when we come out of it?
That's so interesting to hear the two of you talk about that. We've had a number of conversations here on Radio Boston, both sort of about how the adults are frazzled and fallen apart. We did a pandemic wall conversation. We've also had all kinds of conversations with educators about concerns about long-term mental health implications for kids. You've both talked about the balance of both. I just get this mental image that when it's all over, everybody's going to be laying on the floor in the house, just sort of trying to crawl along. How do you take care of your own mental health and make sure your kids stay as whole as possible in all of this too? Jenny, maybe you first.
Yeah, that's such a great question. I think I'd love to hear from people how they're attending to it. I mean, we've tried again to get outside when we can, be grateful when we can, express gratitude when we can. I think this is an ongoing question. You know, I think one of the things we all are hoping for is an idea of certainty. And sometimes our certainty can lead us astray in the sense that we can focus on things that maybe aren't the right direction forward because we're so certain about how they may end up. So I'm, again, just trying really hard to focus on what I can control today. Even in this moment, and doing the best that I can. And if something doesn't go well, to forgive each other and to forgive myself and try better tomorrow. Because long-term planning, if anything this year has taught me, can disappear quite quickly. And flexibility is something that I'm working on and I'm trying to, you know, create amongst my children. I have also, I would say too, just to, as a more positive note, been so incredibly moved by their resiliency. I mean, the idea that we would be a year and not entering a school building and that they would continue to get up every day and try the best they can is a revelation and a good lesson for me as well.
So let's narrow this conversation for a little while now, specifically to work and motherhood. And listeners, I want to invite your experiences. Abbott's either a working mother during this time or an out-of-work mother during this time, or someone who has new challenges as a stay-at-home mom during this time. Let's put motherhood front and center and tell us about your challenges, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kiana, how have you thought about motherhood during this time?
I've, you know, really been struck just thinking about the fact that it's even equal pay day today, you know, and what does that mean for women? And as a Black woman, what does that mean for my community? And so I understand, you know, with some of the statistics that you shared at the beginning, that this era has long-term economic implications for all women. And so as a small business owner and managing, you know, with my children, I have a 6 and a 10-year-old, it's forced me to have to scale back as far as what I can take on. You know, I can't take on as many clients. I think there's a level of mental focus that I need as a parent, as a caregiver, and as a small business owner, that I just feel so split between my mental capacity that I do find it hard. And so I've had to come to terms with understanding that this is a season, you know, so I do a lot of self-talk, a lot of journaling. I've shared before the role that apps like the Shine app, Insight Timer, the Calm app, those types of things that allow me at the end of the day to decompress and also to have open conversation within my community of moms who are in the same circle. So I have a few online groups that I'm a part of, and we connect sometimes every other week or monthly, where we're able to commiserate, troubleshoot. And I think finding those opportunities to support each other and looking for that within your community, you know, even if you're not able to meet in person, that's been crucial to getting through this past year for me.
Jenny, I was really struck by the reported 3 million women, many of them who are moms, who have dropped out of the workforce over the past year. It is not just mothers who are suffering as working parents. I know that. But we also know that women most often experience the double bind. Women tend to do a disproportionate amount of the caregiving. How has that played out in your household? And what do you think is going on for so many women who have had to drop out of the workforce because of their parenting or other caregiving responsibilities?
I'm so glad that you asked that question. And also, that we're talking about pay equity today, because these are intertwined issues. So I think one really important thing to think about or talk about is that, like so much inequity, COVID didn't create it. It uncovered the invisibility or the often invisibility for many women and the ways in which sort of discriminatory structures impact their lives. So you talked about the double shift, right? That women disproportionately do more of the home health care work within the home, the pay equity piece. So then when you have something like a pandemic, and somebody in the family may lose their job or the school shuts down and somebody has to be home, the person who makes less money and it is more societally appropriate to take on those care duties is the one who does that. And that so often is women. And so I think that, you know, when we think about this, what we have to understand is that these were structural issues that were true before and they will be true after. And in order for us to kind of, we have to renegotiate and rethink these systems, whether they be intimate partner systems and how the balance of work and what that work looks like within the context of the home or around employers and fair wages and including things like a fair minimum wage, which of course, you know, most low wage earners are women and women of color. And so these are feminist issues that need to be attended to make women and working women's lives better. And in so doing, you know, families' lives better over time.
You know, the two of you both referenced equity, pay equity, and other equity issues. I'm struck by a quote that one of our producers gave me as I was getting ready for this today. NPR says, quote, as hundreds of thousands of women dropped out of the workforce in September, and you might remember, so coming out of the quote, you might remember that there was a stretch last year where the majority of lost jobs were essentially lost by women. So back to NPR, quote, Latinas led the way, leaving at nearly 3 times the rate of white women and more than 4 times the rate of African Americans, end quote. And so a little bit more evidence of just all the ways that the experiences of this pandemic can be and are often disproportionately felt. We have public policy decisions to make. The American Rescue Plan actually takes a lot of steps in short-term child relief, child care support, et cetera. But how should we be thinking about long-term fixes to these tough and often inequitable choices that working mothers and working caregivers are facing? Kiana, some thoughts from you.
I think we can't do it alone. I think there's been so many conversations swirling amongst caregivers, and I think specifically women, that sometimes it ends up sounding, you know, like we're in an echo chamber. So I think it's really important to bring people into the conversation within the community. If it's your extended family, even letting your children know, like I even communicate with my children and let them know, look, this is what mom is struggling with right now. And there's a lot going on. And I think beyond just building that empathy and making sure the conversations are not just happening amongst us, being able to see who else is in my sphere that I can call in. And I think it was really exciting, you know, one of the silver linings of remote learning, having both of my children here today, was the ability to see Mayor Janie get sworn in. And what does that mean when she talks about fixing these issues on a local level and bringing equity within the community? So I think there's ways that we can be in communication with our immediate lawmakers, our leaders, and also to call in others who may not necessarily be caregivers, but maybe caregiver adjacent.
Jenny, let me grab a call here and then I'll turn back to you. 800-423-8255. We've got Allison on the line. Allison, I think you're in your car. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, Allison.
I just thank you for having this conversation. I am the mother of a severely disabled daughter, and I feel like the world is now getting a glimpse of what has been my life for almost 28 years because of our lack of support for caregivers and motherhood. I had to wrestle with these decisions soon after she was born. And, you know, through it all, I went back to school. I started my own business. But there has always been this lack of understanding and support. And our family has definitely made financial sacrifices for the sake of being caregivers. And I just would so welcome people to have new eyes and new understanding about women need support to be mentally healthy and to work, which, you know, makes them feel good too.
Allison, thank you so much for calling and sharing your story with us, and we wish you well. Jenny, I want to turn to you after that call from Allison. To use her phrase, are we developing new eyes? And as we return, hopefully, to some new normal, will we remember what we saw with those new eyes and do things differently?
I so hope so. And I just want to say to Allison, you know, I think you're amazing. And, you know, your daughter is so lucky to have you. I have noticed that, you know, again, sometimes an unveiling is a necessary step in addressing a problem. And I have noticed greater interest and women's community groups and invitations for me to speak and people coming together. So I do think people understand that something has been wrong for a while, even if they didn't have the words or sort of eyes to see it in the way that perhaps was most effective in terms of systemic change. So I do hope so. And I do think it is incumbent on us who have experienced this and people like Allison to share our stories when we can, to use our voices, to tell the truth about what these experiences are like and where the problem is situated, right? So it's one thing for me to say, you know, every day I wake up and I sort of feel overwhelmed and I must be doing something wrong versus every day I feel overwhelmed because there's something about the system and the way in which my life has been sort of played out and the pay I receive and the ability to leave and care for my children in a meaningful way is facilitated for me. And those are the things that I'm hoping to change and to make a difference about. So I think these conversations have really opened a door and I hope people will continue to have them and also consider and look to systemic change, not as much about pointing to individual women and saying, you know, she was successful or she wasn't successful and it must be something to do with her.
Kiana, I'm sort of keying in on Jenny's phrase about every day I wake up and I feel overwhelmed. And I've heard that from so many women during this pandemic. I also remember hearing it from so many working mothers before the pandemic. Is there hope for a moment after the pandemic where working mothers and working women aren't saying the same thing?
I think there's the opportunity to realize, you know, now that we've named it and called it out, like how Jenny expressed, I think there's the flexibility not to have trepidation bringing it up or asking your employer or asking for those in your circle to give you that flexibility. And I think that now we've had the language and we've seen what's possible, just like the caller expressed, you know, now so many people are seeing what her reality has been. This has been a period of empathy building and giving language and ways for us to rebuild structures that we didn't think before were immovable.
Jenny, what is something you want to keep that's changed in your working and motherhood and wifehood and personhood life that you want to keep?
I think just my sense of being able to forgive myself or to sort of reshape the ways in which I think about success. It is liberating to understand that every day I'm going to get out there and do the best that I can, and we are going to fail and we're going to succeed, and I can brush myself off and do it tomorrow. And I hope I can continue to hold that with me as I move forward. I think many women are quite tough on themselves. And if I could get a little further away from that moving forward, I think it'll be good for me and potentially for the whole family.
And Kiana, how about you?
Yeah, I agree with putting, you know, or extending more grace to oneself. And I think it's been tough for me to remember to do that at times. And I think as we, I don't know if we're going to close out this era or, you know, how we're going to transform from this period, but I think it's a real opportunity for self-growth and for us as caregivers to really see what are ways that we can mold a better future, you know, for our families and beyond.
Well, I appreciate having you both. That's Kiana Agbai, a Boston parent, entrepreneur, and author of the blog and Instagram account Harlem Lovebirds. Also, Jenny Weiner, a Somerville parent and associate professor of educational leadership at the University of Connecticut. Kiana, Jenny, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Today, we want to spend some time with Jeff Immelt. He was the 16-year CEO of the global giant GE. He took the reins of the storied American company on September 10th, 2001. And his tenure was, and this is his word, controversial. He led General Electric through the fallout from 9/11, the Enron collapse, the 2008 recession, and eventually moving the company's headquarters to Boston. In that time, he aimed to transform the 100-plus-year-old company to be more digital, more green, more nimble. But GE also struggled in that time, losing 30% of share value and some $150 billion in market capitalization. Immelt, who left GE in 2017, is out with a new book about his tenure in the corner office. It's called Hot Seat: What I Learned Leading a Great American Company. Jeff Immelt, welcome to WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So, you know, this question that I want to start with may seem really basic, but I'm interested in your answer, especially having read the book. What exactly is GE?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think GE is a 125-year-old basic American conglomerate. It's changed over time, as it should, as it needed to. And the GE that I kind of led for 16 years was really a high-tech infrastructure company that delivered solutions to customers around the world. But again, I think the fact that it's continued to adapt has also been part of the strategy. You know, Amazon 100 years from now is going to look different than Amazon looks today, as it should.
So you've been clear that with this book, you want to set the record straight on your tenure at this storied company. What was wrong with the narrative about GE in your 16 years as CEO? What did you want to set straight?
Yeah, look, I think I wanted to tell a more complete story. I think that truth equals facts plus context. I felt like the context had gone missing. The company wasn't perfect, but it did a lot more good things than bad. We generated $270 billion of earnings. We were number one in all the businesses we were in. We developed good leaders. We had a very strong reputation. At the same time, as you mentioned in your intro, the stock price didn't work. The succession didn't work as we wanted to. But I think the company was filled with a lot of good people that did their best. And I felt like their story, the work that they did, had really been distorted in the last 3 or 4 years.
You said the company's done more good than bad, and you've really leaned into both challenging and transparent conversations about the company with this book. I want to play with that more good than bad and talk a little bit about challenges of where it's been good then bad. And I'm thinking about places like a Pittsfield, Massachusetts, for example, where there was a long storied relationship between the company and the community. But after the company left, there's a long tail of pollution, for example, in the river there, cleanup that needs to be done. And that changes the sentiment in the relationship with the community when you're gone and there's a long tail of, for example, PCBs. So how do you think about when there's good, then bad? What is the relationship the company needs to have with communities?
Well, gosh, I think we've always tried to be a good citizen. As you've noticed, or as you noted in your intro, we're a company that's more than 125 years old. There are situations in communities where there needs to be continuous vigilance and cleanup. As it pertains to Pittsfield and in the Hudson River and things like that, I think the company always tried to be responsible and do our part, working with the EPA and state authorities. And I think we did that. You know, again, the people that worked in our environmental groups in Pittsfield and throughout the Hudson River, I think they should hold their head high because we were responsible and responsive to the state and federal authorities.
Jeff, I grew up in the Midwest where similar to the GE type of story, you know, there were, for example, lots of communities that were reliant on good middle-class paying jobs from the auto industry that then left. And that has been, as GE, you know, to characterize it as a layperson would, moved out of manufacturing, also a piece of the picture, right? Communities that were built up across middle-class, well-paying jobs that then went away. And again, I'm struck in the book how you talk about shareholder value and understanding your relationship to those obligations. And I'm also struck by people, everyday people who might read the book and want to understand what that long-term responsibility and relationship is like for a company as big, as powerful, and with as much history as GE has had.
Well, gosh, I don't think you know me that well, but my father worked at GE for almost 40 years. So I grew up as one of those middle-class people. I always knew the value of a GE job. Nobody had to explain it to me. I always cherished that. I worked tirelessly to sell our products around the world because that's the only way you can ensure that these jobs will continue to be there and be competitive. In the last decade of my tenure, we moved appliances back to Louisville from Mexico. We invested billions of dollars in aviation technologies. We built wind turbines and life sciences products. And our net increase in manufacturing jobs over the last decade that I was CEO was quite substantial. So again, I actually appreciate your question, but I think to a certain extent, you're talking to the wrong guy in that context, because I kind of lived it my whole life. And I think if you read the book, yes, I talk about shareholder value, but I talk a lot more about employee connection, employee responsibility, and my focus on developing a generation of leaders who really understood where they fit in the world.
You know, you just said you think I'm talking to the wrong guy for that question, which made me think of the fact that there's another guy who figures into the book. We're not talking to him. You talk about him. He's now passed, which is the CEO and former Massachusetts native Jack Welch. I was really, honest to God, I couldn't decide how you wanted me to feel about Welch when the book was over. There were times when I thought you were praising him as a strong leader and times when I thought you were saying you felt he had done a real disservice to the company in his focus on shows of growth. How should we think about Welch's legacy now?
I think you actually answered the question. It's a complicated I had a complicated relationship, I think, in the following way. Jack was an amazing CEO in the era that he served, and he did great things for the company, and really was a fantastic, high energy, high impact leader. But the world changed. The world changed dramatically after 9/11. It was more global. The digital age was very substantial. The whole notion of financial services changed slowly and then quickly. So the world and the company had to look very different. I think really what I hope readers see in the book is how much I learned from him, how much I respected him. But at the same time, following him was sometimes complicated. So I think the way you phrased the question was actually kind of appropriate, because he was amazing. He wasn't perfect, but I know for a fact he always did his best every day, as did I.
I know you've done a wide range of interviews already on this book. I've read some of them. We're Radio Boston, so Boston is in our hearts and in our focus. And obviously, GE came to Boston under your leadership. I was struck by the fact you talk about a lot of the big decisions you made as a leader in the book, everything from, you know, the GE Power deals to your desire to move green to turning GE into a digital company. I was struck by the fact that the desire to move to Boston isn't in the book. Did that not feel to you like a big leadership decision? I mean, it was big for Boston and for Massachusetts.
Yeah, no, fair question. You know, we wrote the book like a story, my co-writer and I, and it was very chronologically based. And to a certain extent, the decision to move to Boston, I was in on the early phases of it, but certainly didn't get it to see it to its conclusion. So I don't think there was any reason to slight it. It was just in the weight of the story, there were so many other things to talk about. But what I will say is, look, that's one that I always felt like was the right thing to do. I no longer live there, but I have great appreciation and respect for Boston. And I just think it's one of the world's great cities, and I'm happy that the company's headquartered there.
You said you didn't get to sort of see it through to its conclusion. We're still in that conclusion. You know, there were millions in tax incentives that were spent to lure GE here, a big headquarters planned in the seaport, talk of 800 jobs. You left. A little of that ended up happening, and I understand you were no longer CEO when many of those promises were broken or the incentives were clawed back, which also happened. But I do wonder, as a former CEO of GE, do you think the corporation owes anything to Boston and to Massachusetts that it hasn't done and needs to or should do?
Well, gosh, that's really an impossible question for me to answer, just because I'm just not current on all the things that are going on with GE. But I will say that companies, including the one that I worked at, do owe communities to be a good citizen, to be a responsible citizen, to live up to the things that you say you're going to do. Look, the only way you stay around for more than a century is because you have a good relationship, you know, what I would call a good win-win relationship with the towns you're in. And Boston, not just today, but over, you know, again, 100 years, has been a part of the GE history. And I think all CEOs, all business people need to respect that.
So you teach business school students now. I noticed that in the book. And, you know, you're focused on lessons in this writing and sort of, you know, looking back on your leadership and getting the perspective on it that sometimes only leaving can change. We talked a little bit earlier in this discussion about shareholder value, which, you know, I don't think it's controversial to say can drive quarterly cycle management decisions. And yet you're talking about a more than 100-year-old company. How do you feel about the overwhelming push towards shareholder value and the fact that that can drive short-term decision-making? And how are you teaching future leaders about those lessons?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the course I teach is really about transformational change, really in the digital arena. So that's been the essence of the course. But I do get a chance to, you know, converse with students about the things I've learned and things like that. And I guess the best thing I can offer is be transparent, know the businesses that you're in, and be true to the businesses that you're in. In our case, the aviation business, which is, you know, still got a factory in Lynn, Massachusetts, it takes decades of investment, tremendous quality control, tremendous science, great workforce. You have to have all those things to be successful in that business. It takes, you know, when you invest in a new engine, it's $1 billion plus. It doesn't pay off for 10 or 20 years. And so I think the important thing is just to be transparent about the business you're in. Investors who are looking for that to be different, or for looking for an aircraft engine to pay back in 6 months, they shouldn't own the stock of the company. So I think it's all about being true to the businesses you're in, and being transparent about what the strategies are. And those are things we always try to do.
One investment you wish you'd made that you didn't?
Oh gosh, I can go back in time and say after 9/11, it was a little bit like COVID in that the commercial aviation business was really completely in a bad cycle. And I wish I had acquired as much of our supply chain as I could have, because over the next 20 years, it would have just been a great investment. And then I just think the company never became as digital as I wanted it to be or as it should be. And I wish we had done more things there as well.
Why was it important for the company to be more digital than it became?
Again, I just think the transformation around how products are used by airlines and hospitals and utilities and wind turbines, it's more about information today than it is about physics of the product, and our ability to be a better partner with our customers is really going to be about new technologies like artificial intelligence and machine learning. And I just think that's, you just have to lean in to those technologies. You know, I sit today in California, and the amount of innovation that's taking place today is just unparalleled. And, you know, going back to the aviation example, you could wake up tomorrow and see Elon Musk announce an all electric aircraft with $10 or $15 billion of funding, and the whole industry would change, and things like that will happen.
We're going to have to end it there. That's Jeff Immelt, former chairman of GE. His new book is Hot Seat, What I Learned Leading a Great American Company. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you.
That's our show for today. I'm Ticiana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.